From New Hampshire Public Radio, I'm Peter Biello, and this is the weekly New Hampshire News Roundup on The Exchange. Election Day is just 4 days away, so today we are answering your questions about voting and discussing poll watching. Also, what is the role of county attorney in criminal justice reform? And how have Black Lives Matter groups across the state translated their advocacy into policy change? All that and more on the weekly New Hampshire News Roundup today. And we're going to start the day with NHPR's Casey McDermott, who has been covering voting issues for NHPR throughout the campaign season. Casey is NHPR's investigative data reporter. Casey, welcome to the program.
Thanks for having me.
And listeners, if you've got a question or a comment about how to vote in New Hampshire, give us a call now. What challenges have you faced as you tried to cast a ballot, and how were they resolved? Were they resolved? Our number is 1-800-892-6477. That's 1-800-892-NHPR. You can also send us an email. The address is exchange@nhpr.org. So, Casey, we're 4 days away from Election Day, November 3rd. How has voting been going in New Hampshire so far?
Well, it's funny. You know, I've had to stop myself from kind of reflexively referring to it as Election Day because people have been voting for a while now.
It's election season.
And yes, exactly. And that's, of course, you know, when the polls are open for people to go and handle everything in person. But, you know, the numbers so far show that quite a lot of New Hampshire residents have already returned their absentee ballots. So as of this Tuesday, the Secretary of State's office has been putting out new numbers each week leading up to the election. About 181,000 absentee ballots had already been returned statewide. So just to put that into context, that's more than two times the number of absentee ballots that were cast in the last presidential election in 2016. And that also amounts to just a little under a quarter of all of the votes that were cast in 2016. In the general election. So we don't know, you know, what the final totals are going to shake out to be. Those ballots still have to be processed and counted and, you know, evaluated for their legitimacy. But, you know, the signs so far point to, you know, at the very least, record-breaking absentee ballot usage when all is said and done.
And worth mentioning, Casey, that, you know, we talked a lot about mail-in voting. Has the state advised that people should stop trying to mail their ballots because they have to arrive by 5 o'clock on Election Day, November 3rd?
Yeah, so that's a really good point to mention. So at this point, if you want to guarantee that your absentee ballot arrives on time, it's probably a good idea to not put it in the mail. So the state recommended actually sending it in 2 weeks ahead of time, which would have been not this week, but the previous week. The Postal Service, according to their standards, had recommended about a week, which would have been this week. So now at this point, what you can do is you can drop your ballot off during, you know, if your clerk is open right now on Friday. You can see what their hours are and see if they're available to field your absentee ballot that way. The other thing to keep in mind, though, is that every clerk's office in New Hampshire, regardless of, you know, large or small town, city or town, has to be open on Monday to accept absentee ballots between 3 and 5 p.m. So that's the window when you can also return your absentee ballot if you want to just, you know, get it in, avoid the mail, and really guarantee that it will arrive. But then you can also show up on Election Day when the polls are open and drop it off then, or you could also have someone drop it off for you, but you have to make sure that person is, you know, falls under the categories of the approved delivery agents that the state allows.
Listeners, if you've got questions or comments about the voting process in New Hampshire, give us a call now. The number is 1-800-892-6477. You can also email exchange@nhpr.org. And let's talk to Roland from Concord. Roland, thank you very much for calling. What's your question?
Hi. So I have my absentee ballot in hand. I've already filled it out. And I know that I can either drop it off at the town hall beforehand or bring it to the polling station and return it then on voting day. But what I was wondering is, if I do go to the polling station on voting day, can't I simply take it out of the envelope and put it into the machine myself?
Thank you very much, Roland. Casey.
I don't believe that Roland can do that. I would encourage Roland to contact his local clerk's office just to confirm that. But I believe that if you have an absentee ballot, you can't just take it out and treat it like a normal ballot. There are special processes to make sure that ballots are accounted for. And from what Roland's describing, it sounds like that may interfere with those processes in place that are designed to ensure a smooth election.
Is that a good rule of thumb, Casey? Like, when in doubt, ask your local clerk what the process should be?
Yeah. When in doubt, ask your local clerk. The other thing that you can do is you can call the state's election hotlines. So the AG's office has been operating an election hotline, you know, for the last several months and does this every year. This is not something that's new. That number is 866-868-3703. And they can also be emailed at electionlaw@doj.nh.gov. And they say if you don't get someone live when you call, leave a voicemail, and they make it a priority to respond to every person. So that's they are the kind of authoritative source on election law in New Hampshire.
And for those who weren't ready to write that down as you were saying it, Casey, can they go to nhpr.org's voting guide?
Yeah, we've been trying to append that on nearly every story that we write about the election.
Right.
So please head on over to nhpr.org if you need to look that up.
Great. Thank you very much. Let's talk with Joanne in Newmarket. Joanne, thank you for calling. What's your question?
Yes. Can you please clarify? Because my understanding was if you had requested a mail-in ballot, that had to go back to your town clerk, that it will not be accepted at the polling spots on Tuesday. So that just, to me, needs clarification for the listener, or maybe someone there knows that answer. So thanks.
Thank you, Joanne.
Sure. So you can return an absentee ballot if you have one sent back yet or haven't handed back yet. You can drop that off in person at your polling place on election day. However, if you're doing that, you need to get that ballot in by 5 p.m. So there's a 5 p.m. cutoff for absentee ballots that are being returned by voters by mail or by hand, and that's 5 p.m. on election day. But every polling place in the state has received guidance from state election officials that they are to accept absentee ballots on site during that window.
But it's not a different ballot. In other words, you could submit that same ballot to your town clerk today or on election day at the polling place.
Yes.
Okay.
Yes.
Same ballot works in both places. Thank you very much, Joanne. Really appreciate the question. Again, this is a great chance for you to ask your questions about the voting process if you have them. 1-800-892-6477. Casey, I want to ask you about poll watching because that's been in the news a little bit. Is poll watching allowed in New Hampshire, and what does it consist of?
So I think we probably just want to clarify what we're talking about here.
Sure.
And first of all, and I understand how this can be confusing. Like, I have to look this up a lot, too, because there's a lot of different terminology flying around. But it's important to remember that in New Hampshire, elections are public. They're like public meetings, like your select board or anything like that. So anyone can observe the election process. However, there's two different categories of people who are observers. There's observers, and then there's challengers. And a challenger is someone who has a special status. They must have a letter of appointment from one of the political parties. Usually the state says that will be signed by the chair of, the Republicans or the Democrats. And the challenger has kind of special privileges in terms of, they have to be able to hear certain parts of the election process. They have to be able to see certain parts of the election process. But observers don't have other kind of specific statutory rights as outlined in the law. So that's something that's important to keep in mind, is that there's a set of laws that govern what a challenger can and can't do in New Hampshire polling places on election day, and what observers can and can't do. And local election officials across the state have been briefed on, you know, how to handle those situations over the last few months.
Worth mentioning that neither of those is new to this election, right? This has been part of the process for years.
Yes.
But some of the concerns this year have swirled around the possibility of voter intimidation. And you recently reported that the New Hampshire Attorney General's office said guns will be allowed in polling places, but voter intimidation will not be. So Casey, how does the state plan to enforce that rule?
So, you know, the state certainly is going to be on alert, as will actually the U.S. Attorney's Office, because they also have jurisdiction over, you know, the election process. So the AG's office issued a memo where they kind of outlined these issues in more detail. You can find that on the Attorney General's website. But in there, they note that, you know, people at polling places are prohibited from intimidating voters. And here's how they define that. They say threats of force, violence, or any tactic of coercion or intimidation intended to induce or compel any person to refrain from registering to vote, voting, refrain from voting, or to vote or refrain from voting from any particular candidate or measure must be dealt with by the moderator. And that's basically a long way of saying, look, you shouldn't be interfering with anyone else's voting process or registering process. And if you are, you know, the moderator at your polling place is allowed to work through that and try to de-escalate the situation. However, local election officials have also been encouraged to, you know, use the existing partnerships that they have with local law enforcement. Many New Hampshire voters are already familiar with, you know, having a local police officer at their polling place from time to time on election day. That's not new because of this year, but that's something where the state has been trying to kind of encourage the local police departments and local election officials to really be proactive and really be working together. Hopefully they won't be needed in any kind of urgent manner, but so that that's there in case some kind of issue does arise.
Mm-hmm. And if someone is intimidating or threatening a voter, what are the repercussions?
Well, it's a crime. It's a crime. And the state makes that clear, that it's a felony. They say voter suppression or intimidation will not be tolerated. This is, however, something that, like, you know, the AG's office will look at the situation, evaluate the situation, you know, in conjunction with other kind of enforcement agencies. So we can't say definitively, like, what each specific situation, the outcome will be. But what people should know is that in every meeting that I've been in, and I've been sitting in on kind of planning and information sessions for this election with election officials over the last few months throughout the summer, you know, the state has been very clear that they are not, you know, that they are taking this seriously. Local election officials are taking this seriously and, you know, want to make sure that this voting process is as smooth and as safe as possible for everyone.
Casey, we got this voicemail from a listener, Catherine in Keene, who has a question about absentee ballots. Let's listen to her question. Oh, I apologize. It doesn't seem like we have Catherine ready, but her question is something to the effect of, it's her understanding that absentee ballots are only counted if the election is close. Is that the case this year, or will absentee ballots be counted prior to deciding the election?
So that is never the case in New Hampshire. And again, I don't want to sound dismissive, because I know that there's a lot of confusing claims floating around there about the election in New Hampshire, and really nationally too. But what's important to know is that in New Hampshire, absentee ballots and, you know, the ballots that people count, that people cast in person, are counted one and the same. They both go into the same ballot box. They both go into the same ballot counting machine if you live in a town that uses one of those. And they are counted, you know, in the same pile. So at the end of the night, you don't know which ballot was from an absentee voter or which ballot was from an in-person voter. And the other thing that I should point out is that towns are already starting to process ballots. They started that yesterday because of a special change in the law that was designed to help them process all of the extra paperwork because of the surge in absentee voting. So that means that basically they can kind of, you know, take the ballot out of its outer envelope, check, you know, that people are following all the rules for absentee voting, but they won't take the actual ballot outside of that inner envelope that you sign when you're returning your absentee ballot. It gets set aside, put into a pile, and then it doesn't get counted and processed and put into the ballot box until election day. So that's, again, just a long-winded way of explaining that, like, there's a lot of steps in this process, but those steps are really designed to make sure that, like, every ballot is accounted for, every ballot is, you know, carefully handled, and that, you know, every eligible ballot is counted, regardless of whether it comes from an absentee or an in-person voter.
Casey, we got this email from a listener, Mackenzie in Nottingham, who wrote in with concerns about a new policy in the town of Nottingham. The policy was that only those planning to register and or cast a ballot would be allowed inside the polling area to prevent the spread of the coronavirus. The town went farther to say, please make plans to leave children at home. And Mackenzie writes, I understand the public health concern and therefore perhaps the reasoning behind this policy. However, I'm concerned that this may deter families who have no childcare option from voting. In my opinion, this is voter intimidation. Casey, what do you make of this?
So I followed up on this with the state yesterday, just because I wanted to clarify my understanding of the rules on this. And I should be clear that it's not clear that this is actually a policy of this particular community. This is something that was posted on Facebook from local election officials, or a page purporting to be local election officials in a particular community, that prompted the email to us. And as I understand it, you know, some contact with the AG's office as well. But the long story, the short answer is that there is no prohibition on bringing kids to polling places. And I talked to Assistant Attorney General Nicholas Chang-Yen about this last night. And here's what he told me, just to clear things up for people.
There isn't a prohibition on people bringing children along. I think, though, what it's likely done was intending to try and manage social distancing at the polling place. I'm not sure how large Nottingham's polling place is, but I know a lot of smaller communities express concern about social distancing, COVID-19 concerns, and so on. And this might just be a good faith attempt on trying to manage that, not necessarily prohibit people that end up showing up with children at the polling place, but with an eye toward making sure that public health guidelines can more easily be maintained at the polling place.
Okay, so no prohibition on bringing children along to the polling place. So if you've got to bring your kid, you can bring your kid if you want to.
You can, but again, and you know, this is not a discouragement of anyone bringing their child to the polling place. I know, you know, when I was growing up, that was like a really cool thing that I got to do, was to go
Same
along
here.
With mom and dad when
yep.
they voted. But at the same time, I think that the point that the AG's office brought up is a fair one, that all of this emphasis on absentee voting has been really done with the goal of, in large part, cutting down on crowding at polling places on election day. And that's done with public health in mind. So you just want to make sure that you're balancing those considerations. But again, if you can't secure childcare or for any other reason, you don't need to worry about not voting because you can't, because you need to bring your child along.
Well, Casey, with respect to safety and social distancing, I remember during the primary, there were at some polling places the option of casting a ballot outside. Now, we look outside this morning and the weather is not terribly comfortable out there. I don't know if polling places for the general election are prepared to allow people to vote outside as well. Is that the case as far as you know?
That is the case as far as I know. I think there are places that are setting up tents. There's also, you know, alternative voting methods that are being established for people who cannot or will not wear a mask inside polling places that require it. Again, that's a rule that will vary town by town, but towns are allowed to require people to wear masks inside the polling place, but they have to allow voters some other alternate means of casting a ballot on site.
We got this note from Barb who asks, I have heard that we can change our mind. I applied for an absentee ballot because of COVID, but I now want to vote in person. How can I do this? I was told I can turn in my absentee ballot, it will be voided, and then I can vote in person. And Sean had a similar email. He says, I've requested an absentee ballot, but have decided to vote in person. Do I need to bring my absentee ballot or alert my town clerk before I can vote in person? So what do you think, Casey?
So I would double check with their local election officials about the specific procedures that those officials want them to follow in terms of like keeping track of the ballots. But so far as I know, you do not have to cast an absentee ballot if you have requested it. You can change your mind. There is only, you know, one absentee ballot to a person, unless, you know, for example, that ballot was spoiled, you know, maybe it got, I don't know, say something happened to it. But there's one ballot, one person, and that goes for absentee voting. But you can, if you change your mind, if you don't feel comfortable voting absentee, if you just, you know, want to show up in person and handle the process that way, you can show up at your polling place on Tuesday, anytime during normal hours, and at any time after 5 p.m., I should say, too. We've been stressing that deadline for people to return completed absentee ballots, but that's not the time that polls close. You can vote in person anytime before polls close in your community, but you want to just double check what the hours are where you live.
Just a few minutes left to get your questions about ballots and voting into us. Call now to get it answered, 1-800-892-6477, 1-800-892-NHPR. Casey, how are poll workers and town or city clerks preparing for Election Day Tuesday? There's a lot that'll be different this year than in other years.
There is, and we could fill an hour with that conversation because there's been a lot of work that local election officials have put in. And actually, I would encourage people to go back and listen. You can find this on our website, or you can also find it, I believe, in the Exchange's podcast feed. But we did a show on this about a week ago where we talked to local election officials about how they were getting ready for next Tuesday. And I would encourage every voter in New Hampshire to listen to that because I think it will give you a real appreciation for the amount of work and the amount of care and the amount of planning that has gone into this election, especially at the local level, where I think we need to remember that town and city clerks are not just responsible for overseeing elections. In many cases, that's the tax collecting office. They deal with dog licensing, a number of other responsibilities in addition to this kind of Herculean one that they have to take on this year. I would just say, you know, if you see a poll worker or see a local election official, you know, always be kind, but definitely be even kinder than you normally would because they've been through a lot the last few months to make sure that everyone can vote.
And Casey, what have we heard from Secretary of State Bill Gardner this year?
So we actually just heard from him earlier this week. He made an appearance on a pre-election kind of huddle that his office has been organizing on a semi-weekly basis, actually, for the last few months. I thought it was interesting that, you know, he's been in his office for about more than four decades. Before that was involved in election policy, things like that, during his time in the State House. And even he said that 2020 is a once in 100 years type of an election. So that kind of gives you a sense of the historic nature of what we're all living through right now and voting through right now. But his office all along has been really trying to project, I think, a sense of calm and has been, you know, providing public reassurances that New Hampshire's elections will run smoothly. So we'll be monitoring certainly for the ways that it's working, but we also do want to hear if people are running into problems. Don't feel like just because it's working out for someone else that you can't speak up if you're running into issues. And we definitely want to hear everyone's perspective, whether it's good, bad, in between. People can email us at elections, that's plural, elections@nhpr.org.
And for questions that remain unanswered, Casey, where can they get an answer before Tuesday?
They can go to the same place, elections@nhpr.org.
Send an email there. Okay. NHPR's Casey McDermott, thank you very much.
Thank you.
This is the weekly New Hampshire News Roundup on The Exchange on NHPR. And coming up after a quick break, the role of the county attorney in the Granite State and New Hampshire's Black Lives Matter movement. What policy changes has it brought? Stay with us. This is The Exchange on NHPR.
Chances are, you're working from home a lot more these days. Hi, I'm Sam Evans Brown, host of Outside In, and if you're like me, you're driving much less. And perhaps you're wondering what to do with that old vehicle you no longer need. Well, you can donate it to NHPR and turn those many miles into shows that you love, like Morning Edition, Wait, Wait, Don't Tell Me, and Outside In. We'll take care of the paperwork and arrange to have it picked up for free at nhpr.org/cardonation.
This is the weekly New Hampshire News Roundup on The Exchange on NHPR. I'm Peter Biello. And right now, we're going to take a few moments to talk about the role of county attorney. It's being reconsidered. If you've got a question about this, give us a call, 1-800-892-6477, or email us. Our address is exchange@nhpr.org. Our guest for this part of the program, Mary McIntyre, NHPR's Morning Edition producer. Welcome, Mary.
Hi, Peter.
So, Mary, you recently reported that there are advocates in New Hampshire who want to reconsider the role of county attorney. So tell us what a county attorney is. What do they do?
Sure. So it's an elected position in each county with a 2-year term. And county attorneys are prosecutors who, you know, oversee some of the most important cases in New Hampshire. That includes felony cases. And police departments, they'll bring their criminal investigations to the county attorney, who then decides, you know, if there's enough evidence to charge someone with a crime. They determine how and which charges should be filed in a case. And then if a defendant is convicted of a crime, the county attorney will give their recommendation for sentencing or help determine a plea bargain.
Okay. And so that's the role they play in New Hampshire's justice system by and large?
Yeah. I mean, they hold a lot of power in the criminal justice system. You know, again, they're making these decisions about charges, sentencing recommendations, and those decisions, you know, have major consequences for a person's life.
So why are some people currently starting to rethink the role of county attorney?
Sure. So prosecutorial reform isn't a new idea, but I think it's starting to gain some more traction as the nation and people in New Hampshire are having conversations about racial equity and the criminal justice system. Because county attorneys hold so much power, advocates are talking about how they should also be held accountable for racial disparities in the criminal justice system, you know, like mass incarceration or differences in sentencing. Advocates like Joseph Lascaz, he's an organizer with the ACLU of New Hampshire, they say the risk of bias at the county attorney level is real, you know, given the discretion that prosecutors have in filing cases. So here's Joseph Lascaz.
When a prosecutor looks over a file in a case, that's all it is to them. It's just a file. It's a case. There isn't that humanizing aspect of them getting to know that person. So they're making decisions based off that, and implicit bias do come into play, and we can see it in the numbers that are at the New Hampshire State Prison.
So, you know, advocates like Lascaz, they would like to see county attorneys attend implicit bias training regularly. They'd also like to see county attorneys keep better track of demographic data relating to their cases, you know, as ways to hold them accountable for the decisions they make.
And how can the work of a county attorney adversely impact people of color?
Sure. So, you know, in New Hampshire, Black and Hispanic people are arrested and incarcerated at higher rates than white people. You know, NHPR found that in an investigation that we did back in 2016. And in my reporting, I talked to UNH law professor Albert Scher, who explained county attorneys play a role in these disparities with the charging decisions or the sentencing recommendations they might make. So here he is.
It's most often the case that judges will follow some version of the prosecutor's recommendation for sentencing. So the disproportionate numbers in prisons and jails is very much a function of the disproportionate sentence recommendations relating to people of color by prosecutors.
So, you know, again, prosecutors, county attorneys, just like anyone else, can have implicit bias, just like any other person who serves a role in the criminal justice system, which, again, is why advocates would like to see county attorneys attend implicit bias training regularly.
Okay. And what are some of the candidates for county attorney saying about how they'll change the role of county attorney? Or maybe they don't want to change it. Maybe they want to leave it as is.
Right. So, you know, traditionally, candidates running for county attorney, they try to paint themselves as tough on crime and as advocates for victims. You know, usually the campaigns are less about your typical partisan talking points and more about who's actually going to better support cops, the police. But, you know, for the first time, we have candidates in New Hampshire who are running for county attorney talking about racial justice and the need for police reform. The ACLU of New Hampshire actually sent out a survey to all the county attorney candidates asking them about whether they believe systemic racism plays a role in the criminal justice system. And, you know, the responses were pretty varied. Some candidates said, yes, systemic racism is a problem. Some were vague in their answers, and others flat out denied that systemic racism exists in New Hampshire. So it's a new conversation that's coming up in these races for county attorney.
All right. County attorney on the ballot now through Tuesday. NHPR's Mary McIntyre, thank you very much for speaking with me. Really appreciate it.
Thank you, Peter.
More now on the issue of efforts to correct racial injustices in New Hampshire. Black Lives Matter activists have been at the forefront of this movement. And this summer, following the death of George Floyd in Minneapolis at the hands of police, those efforts have picked up momentum. They've been holding rallies, talking with politicians, and serving on commissions designed to eliminate systemic racism. But has all this activism resulted in any policy victories? Joining us now is NHPR's Sarah Gibson. She's NHPR's education reporter. She's with us by Skype. Welcome, Sarah.
Hi, Peter.
So you recently did some reporting on how the Black Lives Matter movement is working to translate this momentum into policy change. So has it? What's been happening?
Well, it's a bit hard to say just because we are in an election season where there's lots of talk about policies and very little policymaking. So, you know, this is something that people have been keeping an eye on as it's kind of evolved from really a moment in New Hampshire's history where we just had very unprecedented numbers of people out in the streets or in front of the state house calling, you know, for officials and other, you know, communities to really address racial injustice. And now, right before the election, there's this question about, you know, how does this become policy change? I will say in July, soon after some of those biggest gatherings, Governor Sununu did sign a bill into law. It was a criminal justice reform bill. It was largely drafted by Democrats. Sununu said it was just a first step. It was touted as an a real win for criminal justice, but Black Lives Matter activists actually were quite disappointed in it. They said it didn't actually ban chokeholds, and other criminal justice reform advocates said it actually kind of backtracked on some of the bail reforms that they had advocated for. You know, so that was kind of a disappointment to some Black Lives Matter activists. There also has been, you know, this Law Enforcement Accountability Community and Transparency Commission that one of the Black Lives Matter organizers from Manchester, Ronel Chella, served on. And they issued a ton of recommendations to Governor Sununu, and he's actually taken all of those up. And so we should see in the coming months, you know, after the election, to what extent lawmakers want to put those into action. And that's a pretty comprehensive, you know, set of recommendations, everything from body cameras to implicit bias training. So I think that the policy change is to come and is not necessarily something we're going to see in the weeks before the election.
I see. So what more are Black Lives Matter leaders looking for from politicians in addition to those things that you just mentioned?
Well, I think there's a sense that, you know, the white voter and white politician appetite for racial justice issues really waxes and wanes. I mean, and we see this on a national scale, too, when there is a police killing of a Black person. A lot of people take to the streets, a lot of, you know, white allies or people who identify as, you know, pro-racial justice. they're out in the street or on social media for a couple weeks, but then they start backtracking or become less interested. And Black Lives Matter activists I spoke to said they have seen that to some extent from politicians, people who maybe were, you know, showing up to their events in the summer, but no longer are. People who said they really stood by Black Lives Matter, but then have, in Black Lives Matter activists' opinion, really flip-flopped on some of the issues. And in those cases, Black Lives Matter organizers do call out politicians. So, for instance, Dan Feltes, the gubernatorial candidate for the Democratic Party, you know, he has been called out multiple times by Black Lives Matter activists for, you know, saying he supports the movement, but then, you know, slightly changing or seemingly changing his position on commuting a death penalty sentence, or for instance, you know, talking about qualified immunity for police officers. So there have been some shifts from elected officials or from candidates that Black Lives Matter says is a, you know, a reflection to some extent of a desire to appeal to moderate voters, and maybe just Black Lives Matter as an issue not seeming as important to some of those voters or to some of those politicians.
And Black Lives Matter Seacoast had issued a list of demands to lawmakers up and down the ballot. To your knowledge, Sarah, have any lawmakers explicitly responded to those demands?
My understanding from Black Lives Matter Seacoast is that they've had a number of responses that it's a little hard to tell numerically, but
hard to summarize too, because there were so many demands.
It's hard to summarize, and there are so many demands. They said a lot of Republicans got back to them. Most Democrats did get back to them. And they said, you know, many of those people said that they would respond to those demands and take them into account, you know, if they were to be in office. My understanding is that it was about 50% of Republicans said they would, and a much higher percentage of Democrats said so.
Okay. So what are local Black Lives Matter groups focusing on now? Has the tone or their message shifted at all in recent months?
Well, they're certainly involved in Get Out the Vote efforts. For instance, tonight there's a virtual gathering from organized by Black Lives Matter Manchester and Black Lives Matter Nashua. And, you know, they're talking about the importance of down ballot races. They're talking about local issues. They have not gone so far as to endorse any candidate. Black Lives Matter as a national organization does not do that, nor do the local chapters. They say that they want, you know, some distance from a specific party so that they can really work with people on all sides of the aisle on criminal justice reform and on racial justice issues after the election. So, but they are encouraging people to get out the vote. And, you know, you certainly will hear at a Black Lives Matter event, people not just calling out, you know, the Democrats who claim to be allies, but there's a lot of kind of where's Chris or what's, you know, is Sununu actually going to stand by us? So a lot of skepticism also of Governor Chris Sununu. But a lot of their efforts have been with Get Out the Vote. But there's also a new kind of hashtag and movement that they're starting called NH is Not Innocent. The idea with this is that regardless of who wins, you know, next week in the elections, there is a longer effort underway, and there needs to be a longer kind of movement building effort to call out racism wherever it is in New Hampshire and remind people that even though, you know, we haven't had the same kind of police violence or police killings that, you know, the nation turned its attention to earlier this year, there is still systemic racism in New Hampshire, and it plays out in the criminal justice system, and it plays out in events like, you know, Representative James Spillane of Deerfield joking on Facebook that people should burn and loot the homes of BLM supporters. That, for instance, took place last month. Republicans did not really say much about it. Democrats said that representative should resign. And Black Lives Matter showed up in a kind of NH is Not Innocent rally in Deerfield, calling out Representative Spillane and saying it's not okay to incite violence against supporters of Black Lives Matter. That's an example of a conversation about, you know, the ways that racism shows up in New Hampshire. And activists I've spoken to say they really want to continue that conversation and encourage people, white people largely, to be better allies to them when there are those kinds of instances in New Hampshire. So I think we'll see more of that in the months to come after the election.
And Sarah, among those leaders of Black Lives Matter that you've spoken to, how much optimism is there that this next election will bring about meaningful change?
You know, I don't think Black Lives Matter activists, at least those I've spoken to, are really pinning all their hopes on the election. Racial justice, social justice movements, particularly those that are controversial, which Black Lives Matter is, they meet with a lot of resistance. They do not start or end with an election. And so, you know, while you will hear at a Black Lives Matter protest or rally or gathering, make sure to get out to vote, bring all your friends to vote, vote like racial justice matters to you, you know, vote like your mom is Black. You'll hear those kinds of things. But they, you know, they don't think that the election is going to end racial injustice, nor do they think that, you know, people in office always stick by what their platforms were. So there is a real sense that regardless of who wins next week, Black Lives Matter activists are going to need to hold them accountable once they're in office. So, you know, certainly you hear a lot of dump Trump and, you know, anti-Trump language among supporters and to some extent among activists and leaders of Black Lives Matter at these events. But there's a sense from them that, you know, there's work to be done regardless of what party is in power, starting, you know, next week or as long as it takes for us to know the results of the election.
NHPR's Sarah Gibson, thank you very much for sharing your insight with us. We really appreciate it.
You're welcome.
This is the weekly New Hampshire News Roundup on The Exchange on NHPR. I'm Peter Biello. Still to come after a quick break, we're going to speak with NHPR senior political reporter Josh Rogers, who'll give us an update on the state of several statewide races this season. So if you've got questions about any of those, whether it's governor, one of the congressional races, or the Senate race, or another race, give us a call. The number is 1-800-892-6477, 1-800-892-NHPR. You can also send us an email. The address is exchange@nhpr.org or post on our Facebook page to search for NHPR Exchange. That's all one word. And leave us a comment there. This is the Roundup on NHPR. I'm Peter Biello, and we'll be right back.
Fall cleanup projects around the house can be a lot of work, with leaves to rake, gutters to clean, and wood to stack. But donating that old vehicle you no longer use to NHPR is as easy as pumpkin pie. Free up some space in your garage this autumn, all while supporting the public radio programs you rely on. We'll take care of the paperwork and even arrange to tow away your old car, truck, or boat for free. Learn more today at nhpr.org/cardonation.
Welcome back. Thanks so much for tuning in. This is the weekly New Hampshire News Roundup on The Exchange on NHPR. I'm Peter Biello. In this hour, we're going to take a look at the final days of local political races. So what races are you watching closely? If you've got questions, give us a call now. Our number, 1-800-892-6477, 1-800-892-NHPR, or email. The address is exchange@nhpr.org. Our guest for this part of the program, Josh Rogers, NHPR's senior political reporter. Hey, Josh, welcome.
Good morning, Peter. How are you?
Doing well, thank you. So President Trump held a rally in Manchester earlier this week. What issues did he choose to highlight in the Granite State? Anything surprising to you?
I mean, nothing terribly surprising. The president you know, focused on the economy. He made the claim, dubious claim, that we're rounding the corner when it comes to dealing with the coronavirus. In terms of New Hampshire specific stuff, he certainly emphasized that New Hampshire helped launch him politically. This is the first state he carried in the 2016 GOP primary, and it's clear that he likes to visit New Hampshire. It allows him to recall a good time for him politically. And, you know, there were thousands of people there, a lot of hardcore Trump supporters from really across the region. I talked to people who had traveled up from Cape Cod. I talked to some person who drove down from Millinocket, Maine, which is quite a haul. So there were a lot of people. They were excited. And, you know, the president also emphasized the need to really get out and vote. And, you know, this speech was, you know, his remarks were really to rally, you know, core supporters and have them spread the word. There wasn't much outreach to voters who, you know, could be on the fence. And it's hard to know how many of such voters exist at the moment.
Okay. Well, other races to look at, there's the Senate race in New Hampshire. Democrat Jean Shaheen seems to be polling better than her opponent, Republican Corky Messner. What's going on in that race, Josh?
Well, I think it's fair to say that Senator Shaheen is looking pretty strong. She's a formidable campaigner, and you know she's well regarded by most voters in New Hampshire. The record would reflect. Corky Messner, meanwhile, isn't really well known. I mean, he's essentially a Colorado transplant who had a vacation house here. He's self-funding his campaign largely, and he got into this race as a Trump ally and by branding Senator Shaheen as essentially a creature of Washington who kind of left New Hampshire behind some years ago. It's, you know, kind of an off-the-shelf campaign when you're running against an incumbent. And Jean Shaheen's certainly not flashy, but, you know, she's only lost once in five statewide elections. And, you know, that's certainly not a coincidence.
Let's go to the phones and talk to Dave in Concord. Dave, thanks for calling. What's your question?
Well, I'm a native New Hampshireite, and I'm not saying you have to be a native New Hampshireite to run, but you should. I mean, how long has Mauer's been here or Messner? Maybe 2 years at the most, and they feel they deserve to be elected to represent us. I don't agree with that at all. And Messner may be self-funding his candidacy, but is it with stolen money that he got from Colorado? Or, I mean, I know he's been cleared, so I won't go there. But I just feel they're sleazy, and I don't feel they deserve to be elected in New Hampshire.
Dave, thanks for your comments. We definitely don't want to say anything that can't be fact-checked in real time. But we do want to address your comment about people moving here from out of state, because that has been an issue in Corky Messner's campaign, and people have mentioned that as well about Matt Mowers, who's running as a Republican in New Hampshire's first congressional district. Josh, to what extent is this claim of carpetbagger making an impact on voters this election season?
I mean, it is true that New Hampshire actually has a pretty high population of in-migration and a relatively low percentage of native-born residents compared to the rest of the country and other New England states. But, you know, moving here and running for federal office, you know, may be a different thing. And both Messner and Mowers meet the residency requirements to get on the ballot. But, you know, it's a fair critique that their ties to New Hampshire, you know, are relatively thin. You know, Messner has not even voted in a U.S. Senate race in New Hampshire before, and he's only voted once here, and it was absentee. I mean, that didn't stop him from winning the primary, where he faced Don Baldock, whose, you know, family goes back in New Hampshire for many generations. You know, we've had people, accusations of carpetbagging in other races. Jean Shaheen's last challenger, you know, Scott Brown, former Massachusetts senator, he had to deal with that a bit, although his ties to New Hampshire were more longstanding than Messner. And, you know, you think back in the Democratic congressional race in the first congressional district last time, we had Maura Sullivan, who, was accused of essentially moving here for politics. You know, it hangs over Mowers and Messner, and you know, both of them have tried to you know, kind of turn this on its head. I mean, in the first CD, we have a situation where you have Mowers facing Chris Pappas, who's a Manchester native. His family, owned the Puritan backroom restaurant for, you know, a long, long time. You have Mowers making the claim that Pappas has essentially forsaken New Hampshire for D.C.-style politics. It's kind of a similar argument to what Messner's making against Shaheen. And, you know, we'll see what voters make of it. I mean, certainly Mowers and Pappas, that appears to be the tightest race according to the polls. And, you know, Mowers has done he's run an aggressive campaign, and he's done a good job of finding issues that allow him to criticize Pappas as not representing New Hampshire values. And, you know, we'll see what voters make of them. He's lined up Republicans who had supported Pappas before, who said that, you know, he voted in a way he didn't once he got down to D.C. He's made the case that Pappas has been insufficiently supportive of law enforcement. Again, a lot of these arguments are kind of small bore versions of critiques that President Trump is making against Democrats. But that's certainly the tightest race, according to the polls, the first congressional district.
Okay. Well, let's take a look at the governor's race for a moment, Josh. What's the state of that?
Well, Governor Sununu's looking pretty strong, if you believe the polls. I mean, how the top of the ticket, President Trump does, you know, certainly that can carry down. I mean, this is looking like kind of a ticket splitting year, if you believe the polls in New Hampshire, where you might have voters voting for Joe Biden and voting for Governor Sununu, or voting for Gene Shaheen and voting for Governor Sununu, according to the polls. The governor's running and stressing largely his management of the coronavirus crisis. Dan Feltes, his Democratic challenger, is meanwhile working hard to cast Sununu as a Trump ally and as an impediment to progress in Concord. You know, one thing that's been interesting for the governor to watch him is the degree to which he's emphasizing also campaigning on behalf of the entire Republican ticket. And, you know, he's certainly the most popular Republican in New Hampshire, more popular than President Trump. And his effect in down ballot races is going to be interesting to watch, particularly when it comes down to who ends up controlling the state house and executive council.
Well, let's talk a little bit about the executive council as part of our last installment of Down Ballot, our series looking at races down the ballot that don't often get a lot of attention. Josh, remind us, what does the executive council do and what kind of power do councilors hold?
Well, the executive council is a 5-member, essentially, you know, oftentimes councilors refer to as a board of directors for state governments, part of the executive branch. You know, it's five members, each representing a chunk of the state. New Hampshire is really the only state with an executive council with the power that New Hampshire's has. It has to award contracts. It controls governmental appointments to, you know, commissioner and lower level, of course, judicial appointments that have to confirm those. It controls the release of money from the Treasury. We saw this a little bit earlier in the year when there was a dispute over COVID spending. It can pardon with the governor. It can pardon people who are convicted of crimes. There's a big constituent service element. You know, the council can also set turnpike toll rates. It's 4-1 Democrats right now. And, you know, it, for the last couple of years, it's been sort of a choke point of sorts for Governor Sununu when it comes to getting his way.
So who usually runs for this position? Who wants to be executive counselor?
That's an interesting question. I mean, it is changing. I mean, it had not until quite recently been broadly seen as a sort of political stepping stone. I mean, Judd Gregg, who was certainly one of the most successful New Hampshire politicians in the last half century, he started as executive counselor before being a congressman, governor, and U.S. senator. But between Judd Gregg and really the last few election cycles, it hadn't really been seen as a place that was a springboard. But, you know, Governor Sununu sat on the executive council for 3 terms. His challenger in 2016, Colin Van Ostern, was an executive counselor. So you had both gubernatorial candidates coming off the executive council. You've had Andrew Valinsky, lost in the Democratic primary this year,
Chris
on the executive council. Pappas, certainly, too, although Pappas as well. I mean, it's interesting because it's not a place where, in some ways, you know, you can make the case that it's a good place for somebody seeking higher office to get their start, because you represent a fifth of the state. You're sort of in the thick of state government, but you're not voting on divisive policy issues. So it allows you to kind of run potentially a little bit more of a blank slate. To your question, though, it used to be a little bit sleepier politically, and oftentimes you had people on the executive council who were really focused on constituent service. Ray Burton, who sat on the council for years and years from District 1, springs to mind in that respect. You know, in some sense that it's become arguably a little bit more partisan than it used to be. But the council, you know, can exert great power and can stymie a governor. The council doesn't have quite the power that it once did in terms of They can't keep, say, a commissioner that they like and a governor wants to get rid of and hold over status for a long time. Once the commissioner's term is up, they have to go after a while. That didn't used to be the case. That was actually a change made when John Lynch was governor. But it's a powerful position that you know, can have a lot of say over how state government operates,
including over nominations to the state Supreme Court, right?
Well, that has been a big issue. That's probably the most high-profile matter this year on the council, was the council's rejection of Governor Sununu's pick to join the Supreme Court, Gordon McDonald. The Governor Sununu had put 2 justices on the 5-member court already. You know, there's a mandatory retirement age of 70 in New Hampshire. When former Chief Bob Lynn stepped down, the governor said he would like to have Gordon McDonald, the attorney general, join the court, and the Democrats on the council blocked it. And, you know, they have three. There's Russ Prescott and Ted Gass as Republicans. But you have Mike Cryins from District 1, Deborah Pignatelli, who's from Nashua, and Andrew Valinsky on the council from Concord. They said Gore McDonald lacked the judicial experience and also, you know, questioned his support of abortion rights, basically. And, you know, this was an angry fight between the council and the governor. And the governor has now left that seat vacant for more than a year, which is, you know, pretty interesting in that the Supreme Court Chief Justice not simply sits on the court, but is also the administrator of a whole branch of government. And, you know, the governor wants McDonald on the court, and he's waiting to see what happens in these elections. And if you get a Republican majority, I think it's all but certain that we're going to see the McDonald nomination brought back, and maybe with a different result.
NHPR's senior political reporter Josh Rogers, thank you very much for being on the program today.
You're welcome, Peter.
And before we close out the show today, just want to keep you all informed on a couple of stories NHPR's newsroom has been following this week. The state reported 4 more deaths from COVID-19 yesterday. All were residents of long-term care facilities, and that brings the total number of deaths due to COVID in the state to 482. 131 new confirmed cases were reported yesterday. Merrimack, Rockingham, and Hillsborough counties are now classified as having a substantial level of community spread. Starting tomorrow, restaurants in the state will be required to record and store the name, phone number, and time of arrival for all patrons. The move is intended to make contact tracing easier as COVID-19 continues to spread, including within dining establishments. And Vermont has put every New Hampshire county on its list of areas with travel restrictions. Anyone traveling between New Hampshire and Vermont for leisure is now required to quarantine for 14 days or 7 days with a negative PCR test for COVID-19. Essential travel is still allowed between the two states without a quarantine or negative test, and that includes commuting to work or school, shopping for groceries, or accessing health care. And that's the program for today, but all the stories that we discussed are at nhpr.org. You can find links there. The Exchange is a production of New Hampshire Public Radio, and today's show is produced by Exchange fellow Jane Vaughn. Our engineer is Dan Colgan. Our executive producer is Michael Brindley. Our senior producer is Ellen Grimm, and our producers are Jessica Hunt and Christina Phillips. Our theme music was composed by Bob Lord. I'm Peter Biello. Thank you very much for listening, and have a great weekend.
The views expressed in this program are those of the individuals and not those of NHPR, its Board of Trustees, or its underwriters. If you liked what you heard, spread the word. Give us a review on Apple Podcasts to help other listeners find us. And thanks.